From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Some say the trouble's in the Pentagon. Some say the trouble's in the street. Some say the president's a paragon. Where's the trouble at the bottom?
Legendary singer and activist Pete Seeger. Today, a Democracy Now! Special.
Realize that little things lead to bigger things. That's what Seeds is all about. And this wonderful parable in the New Testament. The sower scatters seeds. Some seeds fall in the pathway and get stamped on. They don't grow. Some fall in the rocks and they don't grow. But some seeds fall on fallow ground and they grow and multiply a thousandfold.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we spend the hour with the legendary folk singer, banjo player, storyteller, and activist Pete Seeger. For over 60 years, he's been an American icon. In the 1940s, he performed in The Weavers along with Woody Guthrie. In the 50s, he opposed Senator Joseph McCarthy's witch hunt and was almost jailed for refusing to answer questions before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Pete Seeger helped popularize the civil rights anthem, We Shall Not Be Moved. In the 60s, he was a vocal critic of the Vietnam War and inspired a generation of protest singers. He was later at the center of the environmental and anti-nuclear movements. At the age of 87, Pete Seeger continues to perform and be politically active. In 2004, he recorded a song about the Iraq War called Bring Them Home. He was joined on the song by Ani DiFranco, Steve Earle, and Billy Bragg.
If you love this land of the free,
bring them home, bring them home.
Bring all troops back from overseas.
Bring them home, bring them home. Home.
It will make the general sad, I know. Bring them home, bring them home. They want to tangle with the foe. Bring them home, bring them home.
Pete Seeger's music continues to move listeners. Bruce Springsteen has paid tribute to him by releasing We Shall Overcome, the Seeger Sessions. The album features a collection of songs that were once performed by Seeger. In 2004, Pete Seeger joined us in our Firehouse studio to talk about his life and perform a few songs. I began by asking him about his childhood.
My father was a professor of musicology. My mother was a very good violinist. Her mother wanted her to tour and give concerts, but she said, no, I don't have the physique to do that, traveling all the time and staying in hotels. I'm going to raise a family. And I had two older brothers and was born in 1919 here in New York. But my grandparents had a farm upstate, and that's what I remember, camping out in the barn and going swimming in the local brook. And I put up a teepee out in the cow pasture. I had to put a fence around it so the cows didn't break it down. I was a big fan of Native Americans. Did you ever hear of Ernest Thompson Seton? He wrote books about Native Americans. He said, if you want to have role models, don't go to Europe. Right here were men who were strong and women who were strong, and they cooperated. If there was food, everybody shared. If there was no food, everybody, including the chief and his family, were hungry. And that seemed to me the way people should live.
Your parents both taught at Juilliard?
Yes.
And your father also at the University of California, Berkeley?
Well, he was originally in charge of the music department there at the young age of 24, the youngest full professor at the university. But along comes World War I, and he'd been radicalized, as people tend to do when they go to Berkeley. And he made speeches against imperialist war. My mother said, can't you keep your mouth shut? He said, but something's wrong. You should speak out about it. The old New England idea goes back to Sam Adams. And before that, I guess. Well, he got fired. Later on, when the crash of 29 came, the marriage had broken up. He married a young, extraordinary young professor, composer named Ruth Crawford, and had four more children. But he, in those early days, linked up with the communist movement. He and Aaron Copland and Henry Cowell and Mark Blitzstein, another, had a thing they called the Composer's Collective. After all, in Russia, they had collectives this and collective that. And there, they decided, as skilled musicians, they would compose the new music for the new society. Well, their attempts were laughable. Aaron Copland put music to a poem by Alfred Hayes, same man who wrote Joe Hill, and Into the Streets, May 1st. But only a very expert singer could sing it. Tremendous range, and only a very expert pianist could accompany it properly. Of course, no proletariat ever sang him.
So they had an interesting philosophy in raising you. Your mother wanted to formally teach you music, and your dad said, no, you'll wreck it for him?
Well, my father said, let Peter enjoy himself. We'll see what happens. And I think he was curious because he knew I liked music. My mother just left instruments all around the house. So I could bang on a piano or an organ or a marimba, on a squeeze box or a penny whistle or an auto harp. And at age 7, I was given a ukulele. And I've been into fretted instruments ever then, since then. In prep school, I joined the jazz band. And then a few years later, my father took me to a square dance festival in the southern mountains, and I suddenly realized there was a wealth of music in my country that you never heard on the radio. Old-time music, my brother called it, I think a better name than folk music, all over the place. Depending where you are, you hear different kinds of old-time music. And I still feel that I'd like to see people not forget the old songs at the same time they're making up new songs.
Do you remember any of the songs that you heard then?
Oh, good gosh.
You'd like to play now?
I can't play them. My fingers are froze up, and my voice, you hear, I can't really sing anymore. What I do these days, I get the audience singing with me. If I'm singing for children, I'm needless to say, I'm said, kids, you all know this song. If you don't, you will in a minute. She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes, toot, toot. And say, can't you get the toot, toot, toot? Well, pretty soon they're all doing. She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes, toot, toot. And the last verse, it's cumulative, so you repeat all the previous things. She'll be wearing red pajamas when she comes, scratch, scratch. She'll be wearing red pajamas when she comes, scratch, scratch. Wearing red pajamas, she'll be wearing red pajamas. She'll be wearing red pajamas when she comes, scratch, scratch. Yum, yum. Hi, babe. Whoa, back. Toot, toot. And even if the kids never heard the song before, they're doing it with me.
You weren't always going to be a musician, even if you had musical instruments around your house and you played them.
I ran school newspapers for 6 years. At age 12, I started. I remember selling them for a penny. At the next school, I found they had a mimeograph machine. And I'd tried shining shoes to make a little extra cash because my parents gave me practically no allowance. But that was slow going. And when I found I could use the school mimeograph machine, I now collected the news, typed the stencils, sold them the copy for a nickel a copy, and kept the money. Free enterprise. I found out years later that's why they allowed me to stay at school, because the old woman who paid the bills liked my little newspaper. Gave her all the dirt, the gossip. And even in college, I ran, Arthur Kinoy and I were co-editors of the Harvard Progressive.
But you didn't stay at Harvard. You didn't graduate from there.
No, I was disillusioned about academia. One of my professors, I said, do you have to use such long words? And he kind of smirked. He says, well, you have to impress people. Well, he thought it was a joke, but I didn't think it was a joke, and I wasn't sorry when I left. My parents had run out of money. I got too interested in politics and let my mark slip, so I lost my scholarship. Without a scholarship, I couldn't stay there.
Pete, you traveled the South with Alan Lomax, and to a lot of people, that may not be a familiar name.
Alan Lomax was the son of a Texas fella who collected cowboy songs 100 years ago, and that's how we know Home on the Range and other songs like it, Whoopee-Tie-Yi-Yo. And in 1908, he got President Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, to write a short foreword for his book of cowboy songs. 30 years later, he had a son, and Alan was only 22 years old. His father got him installed as the curator of the Archive of American Folk Song in the Library of Congress. And Alan, in a few years, did what most people would take a lifetime to do. With utmost self-confidence, he calls up the head of Columbia Radio and says, "You have a school of the air. Why don't you spend 1 year learning about American folk music? And the Columbia Symphony can play the music after you've heard some old person croak out the old ballad." And if he couldn't find an old person to do it, he got young me, age 19 and 20, and I still sing some of the songs I learned then. "'Tis advertised in Boston, New York, and Buffalo, 500 brave Americans a-wailing for to go, singing, blow ye winds of the morning, blow ye winds, hi-ho, clear away your running gear, and blow, blow, blow." He interviewed the woman who collected that song when she was a teenager sailing on her father's whaling ship in the 19th century. Now as an old woman, she came out with a beautiful book, Songs of American Sailormen. Joanna Colcord was her name. So he interviews her, has me sing a song, and then the symphony orchestra plays it. Well, Alan got me started and many others. He's the man who told Woody Guthrie. He says, "Woody Guthrie, your mission is in life is to write songs. Don't let anything distract you. You're like the people who wrote the ballads of Robin Hood and the ballad of Jesse James. You keep writing ballads as long as you can." And Woody took it to heart. He wasn't a good husband. He was always running off. But he wrote songs, as you know.
Do you remember when you first met Woody Guthrie?
Oh, yeah. I'll never forget it. It was a benefit concert for California agricultural workers on Broadway at midnight. Burl Ives was there, the Golden Gate Quartet, Josh White, Lead Belly, Margot Mayo's square dance group with my wife dancing in it. I sang one song very amateurishly and retired in confusion to a smattering of polite applause. But Woody took over and for 20 minutes entranced everybody, not just with singing, but storytelling. "I come from Oklahoma, you know. It's a rich state. You want some oil? Go down the ground. Get you some hole. Get you some oil. If you want lead, we got lead in Oklahoma. Go down in a hole and get you some lead. If you want coal, we got coal in Oklahoma. Go down a hole, get you some coal. If you want food, clothes, or groceries, just go in the hole and stay there." Then he'd sing a song.
When did you form the Weavers?
That was after World War II. Lee Hayes from Arkansas and his roommate Millard Lampel and I had started a group called the Almanacs. And I wrote to Woody, said, "Woody, we're singing for unions all around. Come on, join us. We're in Madison Square Garden singing for striking transport workers." And so Woody once again deserted his wife, came and joined us. But the the Almanacs is the only group I know that rehearse on stage. We were very badly organized. And after World War II, Lee says, "Pete, do you think we could start a group that would actually rehearse?" And we were fortunate to run into one of the world's greatest singers, Ronnie Gilbert. She was in her early 20s. Beautiful alto voice. And a strong alto voice. I'd have to be 2 inches from the microphone. She could be 2 feet from the microphone, and she'd drown me out. She stood up to 3 strong-voiced men, and the 4 of us, however, were about to break up when we did the unthinkable. We got a job in a nightclub. Well, a little Greenwich Village place, it's still down there, the Village Vanguard. And the owner paid us he didn't want me first. He said, I can't pay for a quartet. I'll pay for you. I'll pay you $200 like I did 2 years ago. I said, well, what if all four of us were willing to come for $200? That was low pay even then. And he had laughed. He said, well, if you're willing. And we got $200 and free hamburgs until a month later he came and saw the size of the hamburgs I was making. He said, let's make that $250, but no more free hamburgs. And we stayed there 6 months. Near the end of it, we met an extraordinary band leader, Gordon Jenkins, who loved our music and got us signed up with Decca. And we had a record called And on the other side, the B-side, was a record, Irene Goodnight, which sprang to number one and for 3 months stayed up there in the top of the hit parade. It was the biggest seller since World War II. And
can you talk more about Irene?
Well, it was the song, the theme song of the great black singer Leadbelly. He died in 49, and if he'd only lived another 6 months, he would have seen his song all over America. It was an old song. He'd simply changed and adapted it, added some verses and changed the melody, what my father called the folk process, by which happens all through all kinds of music. In fact, all culture, you might say. Lawyers adapt old laws to suit new citizens. Cooks adapt old recipes to fit new stomachs. Anyway, I learned this 12-string guitar from Leadbelly. A high string and a low string together, but played together, give a new tone. And the song I really like to sing to you is always have to do with it. I don't sing it anymore. I give the words to the audience and they sing it. I says, you know this song. To everything, turn, 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 there is a season. Sing it. And the whole audience sing, turn, turn. There is a season. And a time, and a time for every purpose under heaven. Time to be born, a time to die. Sing it. A time to be born, a time to plant, to reap. A time to plant, a time to kill, to heal. A time to kill, a time to laugh, to weep. A time to laugh, a time to... You know, those words are 2,256 years old. I didn't know that at the time, but Julius Lester, an old friend of mine, he's a... I don't know if you know him. He's a black man who is officially a Jew. Now, he became fascinated with the Bible, and I asked him, when was these words written? He says, well, the man's name was Koheleth, meaning convoker, somebody who calls people together to speak to them. In the Greek translation, they called him Ecclesiastes, and they still, in the King James Version, this is it. And it's a type of poetry, which is Greek. The Greeks have a word for it, anaphora, A-N-A-P-H-O-R-A, and it means you start off a line with a word or a phrase. You don't have rhyme at the end of the line, but you do have it becomes poetry by the way it's organized. Well, I didn't realize I liked the words, but I realize now those are maybe some of the most fundamentally important words that anybody could learn. You see, you and I, we're all descended from killers, good killers. The ones who are not good killers didn't have descendants. But we're descended from good killers. For millions of years, our ancestors were good killers. As they say, if they hadn't been, we wouldn't be here today. Now is a new period. In other words, there was a time, you might say, the human race needed to have good killers. Now, if we don't change our way of thinking, there will be no human race here. Because science acts very irresponsibly. Oh, any of the information is good. Ha, ha, ha. They don't realize that some information is very important. Some, frankly, forget about until we solve some other problems. Einstein was the first person who said it. Everything has changed now except our way of thinking. And we've got to find ways to change our way of thinking. Sports can do it, arts can do it, cooking can do it, all sorts of good works can do it. Smiles can do it. And I'm of the opinion now that if the human race makes it, I say we've got a 50-50 chance. If the human race makes it, it'll be women working with children. Now, these are two very large oppressed classes in the human race. Children doing what the grown-ups say they're supposed to do, and yet they're going to have to pay for our mistakes. They're going to have to clean up the environment, which has been filled with chemicals, the air being filled with chemicals, the water being filled with chemicals, the ocean being filled with chemicals. And they're going to have to clean it up. And I think it'll be women working with kids that'll do this job in millions of little ways, maybe done in your hometown. In my hometown, we're starting a project to put in a floating swimming pool in the Hudson, because now the Hudson is clean enough to swim in. Let's swim in it. And if it works in our little town, maybe other towns will do it. In fact, if there's swimming pool out, it's like a big netting in the water. So I confess I'm more optimistic now than I was 58 years ago, 59 years ago, when the atom bomb was dropped.
Pete Seeger here on Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Peace out all the
Seeger here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with our conversation with him, he was also joined in 2004 in our studio by Jim Musselman, the founder of Appleseed Records.
Right before the atom bomb was dropped, you did serve in World War II. You were a soldier.
I first wanted to be a mechanic in the Air Force. I thought that'd be an interesting thing. But then military intelligence got interested in my politics. My outfit went on to glory and death, and I stayed there in Keesler Field, Mississippi, picking up cigarette butts. For 6 months, finally, they let me know, yes, they'd been investigating me, opening all my mail. I did finally get permission to go overseas in what they call a special service outfit. And my little company went to the island of Saipan in the Western Pacific. Vic Wirtz, the Detroit outfielder, his job was to set up softball teams all over the island. And there were some good newspaper reporters. Their job was to set up battalion mimeographed newspapers all over the island. We had movie projectors, and they set up 16-millimeter movie theaters all over the island. Little island, 13 miles long, and I was given the job of hospital entertainment, and I got in a jeep and bounced over the island and put up a notice on bulletin boards. If you can entertain in any way, music or jokes, whatever it is, call this number. There's thousands of men back from Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and they need a little cheering up. And I'd book gospel quartets and string bands and jazz combos and magicians. And I'd go join them sometimes. I remember there were Korean forced laborers on the island, and I got permission for them, one of their teachers, to take them through the wards. They'd clip-clop in their wooden sandals. And usually, after the first few notes, smiles would appear over the soldiers' faces. The kids were all singing Protestant hymns in Korean.
Pete Seeger, when you came back, they continued to investigate you.
Well, I have assumed most of my life that if there wasn't a microphone under the bed, They were tapping the phone from time to time and opening my mail from time to time. Who knows? But
it was more than that, wasn't it?
Oh, well, sometimes they'd have picket lines out, but, you know, in a crazy way, all it did was sell tickets. I remember one concert did not sell out. My manager said, Pete, we should have gotten the Birches to picket you. Then it would have sold out.
I'm looking at a transcript of the House Un-American Activities Committee, August 18th, 1955, when they started off by saying, Mr. Taverner said, when and where were you born, Mr. Seeger? You actually answered that question.
Well, I wish I could had spoken up more. I just did what my lawyer, very nice guy, says. Don't try to antagonize him. Just don't answer these questions, because if you answer this kind of question, you're going to have to answer more questions. Just say you don't think it's legal. Well, I said I think I got a right to my opinion, and you have a right to your opinion, period. And so eventually I was called up and sentenced to a year in jail, but my lawyer got me off on bail. I was only in jail for 4 hours, and I learned a folk song. They served us lunch, a slice of bread and a slice of bologna and an apple, and the man next to me was singing, if that judge believes what I say, I'll be leaving for home today. The man next to him says, not if he sees your record, you won't. But that's an old African melody, you know. It's in many, many African-American folk songs.
Jim Musselman, longtime friend and record producer for Pete Seeger.
I just wanted to invoke one thing dealing with the McCarthyer and Pete. Basically, he was one of the few people who invoked the First Amendment in front of the McCarthy Committee. Everyone else had said the Fifth Amendment, the right against self-incrimination, and then they were dismissed. What Pete did and what some other very powerful people who had the guts and the intestinal fortitude to stand up to the committee and say, I'm going to invoke the First Amendment, the right of freedom of association. And I was actually in law school, and I read the case of Seeger versus United States, and it really changed my life because I saw the courage of what he had done and what some other people had done by invoking the First Amendment, saying we're all Americans, we can associate with whoever we want to, and it doesn't matter who we associate. That's what the Founding Fathers set up democracy to be. So I just really feel it's an important part of history that people need to remember.
Now, you were sentenced to a year in jail?
And a year later, the appeals court acquitted me. Ironically, the contradictions of life still amaze me. The judge who acquitted me, the head judge, there were three judges, had one was Irving Kaufman, the man who sentenced the Rosenbergs to the chair 10 years earlier. But he acquitted me. He said, we are not inclined to lightly disregard charges of unconstitutionality, even though they may be made by those unworthy of our respect. However, I feel that both my wife and I feel we're lucky to be alive and lucky to be on good terms with our neighbors. And in the little town where we live, people shout out, hi, Pete. Hi, Toshi. And I wish I could live another 20 years just to see things that are happening, because I believe that women working with children will get men to wake up to what a foolish thing it is to seek power and glory and money in your life. What foolish thing. Here we are. There's a politician in my hometown, a very nice guy. He used to be a shop steward for the union in a local factory, but for 20 years he represented our town in the county legislature. And he said, Pete, if you don't grow, you die. 1 o'clock in the morning, I sat up in bed and thought of the next question. If that's true, if you don't grow, you die, doesn't it follow the quicker you grow, the sooner you die? Nobody is facing up to that question, but it's very definitely true. Now, the first step in solving a problem is to admit there's a problem. Then we can argue about ways it could be solved. I suppose one person say, well, let a few people have trillions of dollars and the rest of the people obediently do the work, and the people in charge will see that everything is done right. On the other hand, I think what was in the Declaration of Independence is true now just as it was then. Those great lines, they're written by Ben Franklin, you know, not Jefferson. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it.
Pete Seeger, can you tell us about We Shall Overcome?
I thought in 1946, when I learned it from a white woman who taught in a union labor school, the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, that the song had been made up in 1946 by tobacco workers, because they sang it out there to strike through the winter of 1946 in Charleston, South Carolina. And they taught the song to Zilphia Horton, the teacher at the labor school. And she said, oh, my favorite song. And I printed it in our little magazine in New York, People's Songs, as We Will Overcome, in 1947. It was a friend of mine, Guy Carawan, who made it famous. He picked up my way of singing it, We Shall Overcome. Although there was another teacher there, Septima Clark, a black woman. She felt that shall, like me, she felt it opened up the mouth better than will. So that's the way she sang it. Anyway, Guy Carawan in 1960 taught it to the young people at the founding convention of SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC for short. And a month later, it wasn't a song, it was the song throughout the South. Only 2 years ago, I get a letter from a professor in Pennsylvania who uncovered an issue of the United Mine Workers Journal of February 1909. And a letter there on the front page says, last year at our strike, we opened every meeting with a prayer and singing that good old song, We Will Overcome. So it's probably a late 19th century union version of what was a well-known gospel song. I'll overcome, I'll overcome, I'll overcome someday.
You sang it for Martin Luther King?
In 1957, I went down to Highlander. Zilphia was dead, and Miles Horton, her husband, said, we can't have a celebration of 25 years of this school without music. Won't you come down and help lead some songs? So I went down, and Dr. King and Reverend Abernathy came up from Alabama to say a few words, and I sang a few songs, and that was one of them. And Braden drove King to a speaking engagement in Kentucky the next day, and she remembers him sitting in the back seat saying, we shall overcome. That song really sticks with you, doesn't it? But he wasn't a song leader. It wasn't until another 3 years that Guy Carawan made it famous.
Jim Musselman, want to add to that?
Yes, I just wanted to interject one thing. Pete has always said that the beauty of his song is how it can be used and reused and changed for different movements and everything. And the song We Shall Overcome, which was used in the Civil Rights Movement, was then used in Tiananmen Square and used in so many movements around the world. And when we put out the first volume of the songs of Pete Seeger, I did the song We Shall Overcome with Bruce Springsteen. And Bruce said I wanted to do a totally different version of the song, and he personalized it and sang it on a personal level like he was singing to one individual. And everybody was at first criticizing us, saying, why would you take that song and personalize it to an individual? And then I started getting letters from parents whose children had leukemia, and they said they were singing Bruce's version of the song to their child that will overcome this disease. And then after the Columbine Massacre, one of the students out there played the song We Shall Overcome that Bruce Springsteen had done out at the Columbine funerals. And then after September 11th, we got a call from NBC News on September 12th, and they wanted to do a video montage of the rescue workers in, and they wanted to use Bruce's song, We Shall Overcome. And the song was played every single hour on the hour by NBC News, and it gave people a sense of hope and a soothing, not only because of Bruce's voice, but also the song that they had known, which had been used to overcome so much adversity throughout our history. And that's the wonderful thing about the songs that Pete has found, is that they keep being used and used and used for different movements. And that's the beauty of not only the songs, but the timeless nature of how they're always going to be used for different things. And it's just beautiful to see the way We Shall Overcome has been used in so many battles and so many people's movements around the world.
Even as you're singing songs like that, it has also often been seen as a tremendous threat to the establishment. And in 1963, the Fire and Police Research Association of Los Angeles warned, before one of your appearances, Pete Seeger, that folk music and youth gatherings were being used to brainwash and subvert vast segments of young people's groups.
Oh, poor old. I hope they've learned a little different now. That's 40 years ago, 41 years ago. But the establishment has always been concerned about music. I've quoted Plato for years, who wrote, "It's very important that the wrong kind of music not be allowed in the Republic." And I've also heard there's an old Arab proverb, "When the king puts the poet on his payroll, he cuts off the tongue of the poet." During the 1930s, I was very conscious that radio stations played nice love songs and funny songs, but only by accident did a song like "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime" get through. The other songs tend to be more like Bing Crosby's hit of 1933, I think, "Wrap Your Troubles in Dreams, Dream Your Troubles Away." That's how we're going to lick the Depression?
Did you know Yip Harburg, who wrote "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime"?
I knew him very well. He was a wonderful guy. And I learned from his son wrote a lovely autobiography, "The Man Who Put the Rainbow in the Wizard of Oz." And he told that is there time to tell that story?
Yes. Well, we have told it on Democracy Now!
Oh, well, then if you told
No. But well, there are many who haven't heard it.
Yip and Harold Arlen, the musician, got this plum of a job to write songs for a musical version of The Wizard of Oz. And they got this song, and then the producer was going to cut it from the show. He said, "It slows up the opening." And they fought like tigers. "This movie is not going to be made unless this song is in it." Finally, it took Louis B. Mayer himself to say, "We're wasting a lot of money sitting around here arguing. Let's get started. Let the boys have their song." And, of course, it's that song that brings back a revival of the movie all the time. It's a great song. I sang it last February 15th, a year ago. Wow. And I was on First Avenue, and there must have been hundreds of thousands of people stretched out. And I said, "You know this song, I'll give you the words." And I gave, just like I did with "Turn, Turn, Turn," I said, "Somewhere Over the Rainbow." And they sang, "Somewhere Over the Rainbow, way up high, way up. There's a land I heard of once in a lullaby." So through the whole song, the hundreds of thousands of people sung it. But near the end, I do this whenever I sing the song. I say, "There's two more short lines to this song, but I have to change two words." And I look heavenward and say, "Somewhere up there," and hear Yip saying, "Pete, you can fool around with your old folk songs, but don't you touch Over the Rainbow, please. Yip, wherever you are, I got to change two words, because if I'd been there when little Dorothy said, 'Why can't I?' I'd tell her, 'You know why you can't, Dorothy? Because you only ask for yourself. You got to ask for everybody, because either we're all going to make it over that rainbow or nobody's going to make it.'" And so sing it. "If plucky little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow, why can't you and I?" And the whole crowd sings these slightly different words. It's beautiful. And, of course, that's the story of Noah's Ark and the rainbow. I'm sure Yip was thinking of that. This world will survive when we learn how to coexist. Okay, we disagree. You like to eat this way, and I like to eat that way. You like to dance that way, I like to dance this way. You think of this word meaning such and such. I use the same word, but I'm thinking of something different. But if we learn the lesson of the rainbow, we will be here 100 years from now.
We're talking to Pete Seeger, and on this allmusic.com bio of you, it says, Pete Seeger's adherence to the sanctity of folk music came to a boiling point with the advent of folk rock, and it's long been rumored that he tried to pull the plug on Bob Dylan's very electrified set with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band in 1965. Is that true?
No. It's true that I don't play electrified instruments. I don't know how to. On the other hand, I've played with people who play them beautifully, and I admire some of them. Howling Wolf was using electrified instruments at Newport just the day before Bob did. But I was furious that the sound was so distorted you could not understand a word that he was singing. He was singing a great song, Maggie's Farm, a great song, but you couldn't understand it. And I ran over to the sound man, said, fix the sound so you can understand him. And they hollered back, no, this is the way they want it. I don't know who they was. But I was so mad, I said, damn, if I had an axe, I'd cut the cable right now. I really was that mad. But I wasn't against Bob going electric. Matter of fact, some of Bob's songs are still my favorites. What an artist he is. What a great... I'd say maybe he and Woody and Buffy St. Marie and Joni Mitchell and Malvina Reynolds are the greatest songwriters of the 20th century. Even though Irving Berlin made the most money, they wrote songs that were trying to help us understand where we are, what we got to do. Still are writing them.
Pete Seeger here on Democracy Now. Back in a minute.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging. We'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy. The big fool says to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
Pete Seeger, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue our conversation.
1967, you made your stand against the Vietnam War clear on the Smothers Brother, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Can you talk about that?
Well, the Smothers Brothers were a big, big success on CBS television. And way back the year before, I think in the spring of 67, they said, CBS says, anything we can do for you, you're right at the top. What can we do to make you happier? And they said, let us have Seeger on. And CBS said, well, we'll think about it. Finally, in October, they said, okay, you can have him on. And I sang this song, waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The tape was made in California, flown to New York, and in New York, they scissored the song out. And now the Smothers Brothers took to the print media and said, CBS is censoring our best jokes. They censored Seeger's best song. And they got some publicity. And during November, December, January, the arguments went on. Finally in late January of 68, CBS said, okay, he can sing the song. On 6 hours' notice, I flew out to California. I remember singing a batch of songs from American history, songs from the Revolution, Why come ye hither, redcoats, you mind what madness fills in our forest? There's danger in our hills, for the rifles, in our hands shall prove no trifle. I think I mentioned the hit song of 1814. It was the hit song. Oh, say, can you see? And the song of the Mexican War. Green grow the lilacs, all sparkling with dew. A love song. That's why Yankees are called gringos in Mexico, from that song. And, of course, the Civil War. Several good songs, not just Battle Hymn of the Republic, but a batch of them. The Spanish-American War. Oscar Brand taught me this song. American soldiers in the Philippines were singing, damn, damn, damn the Filipinos, cross-eyed cockyack ladrone, and beneath the starry flag, civilize them with a crag, and go back to our own beloved home. I didn't sing that. But long come modern times, I sang waist-deep in the Big Muddy, and this time only a station in Detroit cut it out. But the rest of the country heard it, so 7 million people heard it. Who knows? Later that month, in late February, Lyndon Johnson decided not to run for re-election. The song would be probably just one more thing. I honestly believe that the future is going to be millions of little things saving us. I imagine a big seesaw. And at one end of this seesaw is on the ground with a basket half full of big rocks in it. The other end of the seesaw is up in the air. It's got a basket one quarter full of sand. And some of us got teaspoons and we're trying to fill up sand. A lot of people are laughing at us. They say, oh, people like you have been trying to do that for thousands of years and it's not. It's leaking out as fast as you're putting it in. But we're saying we're getting more people with teaspoons all the time. And we think one of these years, you'll see that whole seesaw go zoop in the other direction. And people say, gee, how did it happen so suddenly? Us and all our little teaspoons. Now, Grant, we got to keep putting it in, because if we don't keep putting teaspoons in, it will leak out, and the rocks will go back again. Who knows?
Do you see those cracks, those places today in mass media? I know you don't watch TV and all that, but for example, you going on Smothers Brothers, do you think that it is as constricted today?
Not as constricted, no. There's all sorts of little things going on. I understand this program may be on some TV stations. I've got to find out where, when, so I can see it. You're right. I don't look at TV much except to check on the weathers for my skating rink. And I'm a readaholic. I'm a magazineaholic. I get 40 or 50 magazines a month. And music magazines, environmental magazines, union magazines, civil rights magazines. Who knows?
Can you tell us about where have all the flowers gone?
Oh, I was sitting in an airplane on my way to sing at Oberlin College. I was over Ohio, and
what year?
Half dozing, year 1955. And all of a sudden, three lines which I'd read in a book took form. In the book, it simply said, where are the flowers? The girls have plucked them. Where are the girls? They're all married. Where are the men? They're all in the army. It's an old Russian folk song. And the Don Cossacks, maybe it's a Ukrainian folk song, Koloda Duda is the original name, but I didn't know that. All I knew was I'd read these three lines in the book, and Quiet Flows the Don by a Soviet novelist. And all of a sudden, I had three verses. I didn't realize it at the time. I'd swiped part of the verse from an old Irish song. I'd been recording a lumberjack song from the Adirondacks. Johnson says he'll load more hay, says he'll load 10 times a day. You can see I slowed it down. And I pinned the words to the microphone that night and sang them. And a few weeks later, I was walking down 48th Street, Manhattan, and stopped in at Folkways Records, said, made up a new song. And then he propped Mo Ash, propped a mic up in front of me, and recorded it, and a few months later is out on another LP. An Oberlin College student got the LP and had a job at a summer camp. And the kids were fooling around with verses. Where have all the counselors gone? Broken curfew, everyone. But by the end of the summer, he'd made up the two extra verses we know. Where the soldiers gone? Gone to graveyards. Where the graveyards gone? Covered with flowers. And the kids took the song back to New York. And Peter, Paul, and Mary were singing in the village, in Greenwich Village, and picked it up, started singing it. The Kingston Trio learned it from them. About 3 years later, my manager says, Pete, didn't you write a song called Where Have All the Flowers Gone? And I said, yeah, about 3 years ago. He said, did you copyright it? No, don't guess I ever did. He said, well, you ought to. The Kingston Trio have recorded it. Well, I got on the phone to Dave Gard. He was an old friend. He'd gotten started playing a banjo because he got my book, my bestseller. I mimeographed it first, but later printed it. It's printed 100,000 copies. How to Play the Five-String Banjo. He said, he wrote me a year later, he says, I've been putting that book to hard use. I and two others have a group we call the Kingston Trio. So I called him up. Oh, Pete, we didn't know it was your song. We'll take our name off it. It was very nice of him because technically, legally, I had, as they say, quote, abandoned copyright. But they took their name off, and my manager copyrighted. It pays my taxes these days, that song. It's been translated into dozens of other languages.
Pete, could you play Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Well, I'll sing it more like I wrote it, which had no rhythm. It's like an Irish slow air. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. This is the way Dominic Behan sang it. He's the brother of Brendan Behan, the writer. And he liked it this slow way, like an Irish slow air. Come to think of it, President Kennedy met Dominic Behan once when he went back to Ireland. And he said, you Behan, the singer? And Dominic said, yes. He said, do you know this fellow Seeger? And Dominic said, oh, I know him well. Good man, said Kennedy. And this is when I was still under indictment. But Kennedy, I'd written him a letter, never got an answer, but I'd reminded him that one of his favorite poems was written by my uncle way back in World War I. My uncle Alan got mowed down by a German machine gun about 6 months ago, but he wrote a poem. I have a rendezvous with death at some disputed barricade. When spring comes back with rustling shade and apple blossoms fill the air, I have a rendezvous with death when spring brings back blue days and fair. It may be he shall take my hand and lead me into his dark land and close my eyes and quench my breath. It may be I shall pass him still. I have a rendezvous with death on some scarred slope of battered hill. When spring comes north again next year and the first meadow flowers appear. God knows 'twere better to be deep, pillowed in silk and scented down, where love throbs out in blissful sleep and hushed awakenings are dear. But I have a rendezvous with death at midnight in some flaming town, and I to my pledged word am true. I shall not fail my rendezvous.
Pete, you didn't actually fully sing Where Have All the Flowers Gone. You want to give us a little more of it?
Well, maybe I'll just sing the very, very last verse. Because the contradictions of life still amaze me. You have to laugh if you don't cry. Where have all the graveyards gone? Long time passing. Where have all the graveyards gone? Long time ago. Where have all the graveyards gone? Covered with flowers, everyone. When will we ever learn? When will we ever learn?
You still have your voice.
It's in the cellar.
Can you talk about getting older?
Oh, it's no fun to lose your memory or your hearing or your eyesight, but from my shoulders on down, I'm in better condition than most men at my age are. I can go skiing with the family, although I stick to the intermediate slopes. I don't try the double diamond.
Pete, you sit here listening with headphones on. You're a singer. Sound is very important. It's not as easy for you to hear things so clearly anymore. How has that affected you?
Well, I'm singing to myself all the time, just humming, or just in my brain. I'm not making any sound. Admittedly, I can't, unless I have earphones on, I can't really, even with what they call hearing aids, I can't really hear music anymore. I don't listen to CDs. I don't listen to the radio. I don't listen to TV. And occasionally, when friends come around, I'll join in with them, but my fingers are slowing down. I hear records that I made years ago and said, how did I ever play that so fast? On the other hand, these are exciting times. There's never been such as exciting times. And win, lose, or draw, it's going to be very, very exciting. And I applaud what you are doing. I think what Democracy Now! Is doing is just fantastic. This couldn't have been done half a century ago. Could not have been done.
Why?
Well, they didn't have the technology for it, I guess. So as I say, technology will save us if it doesn't wipe us out first.
Well, final words, Pete Seeger, as we wrap up this conversation. The role of music, culture, and politics.
They're all tangled up. Hooray for tangling.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And for someone who isn't so hopeful, who is listening to this right now, trying to find their way, what would you say?
Realize that little things lead to bigger things. That's what seeds is all about. And this wonderful parable in the New Testament, the sower scatters seeds. Some seeds fall in the pathway and get stamped on. They don't grow. Some fall in the rocks and they don't grow. But some seeds fall on fallow ground and they grow and multiply a thousandfold. Who knows where some good little thing that you've done may bring results years later that you never dreamed of.
Legendary folk singer and activist Pete Seeger here on Democracy Now! To read the transcript or the video or audio podcast or to get a DVD of today's broadcast, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Thanks also to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Megan Whitney, and Samantha Chamblee. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.